Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Ryan Scott. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, sponsored by AstraZeneca, we had the pleasure of speaking with Yara Abdu, MD, on how patient characteristics may affect treatment selection in the second line and beyond in breast cancer, and factors that influence the decision between trastuzumab deruxtecan and trastuzumab amtansine for patients with HER2-positive disease. Dr. Abdu is an assistant professor of medicine in the Department of Medicine, Division of Oncology at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine in Chapel Hill. In our exclusive interview, Abdu discussed how patient characteristics impact treatment selection and highlighted some of the top-line takeaways from breast cancer treatment to come out of the 2023 ASCO annual meeting. Thank you so much again for agreeing to meet with us today to speak a little bit on some updates in breast cancer. So to kick things off, what were your overall perceptions of new data in HR-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer that came out of ASCO this year?
Yeah, so it was pretty exciting overall to see more options for our patients, particularly in the adjuvant setting. We already have abemaciclib, one of the CDK4/6 inhibitors, approved in that setting for the MONARCH study. And then the NATALEE study was presented at ASCO, supporting potentially a new CDK4/6 inhibitor, ribociclib, in the adjuvant setting. So it was nice to see more options opening up for patients. For the metastatic setting, it was nice to see the final analysis of the TROPiCS-02 study confirming the efficacy of sacituzumab govitecan with improvement of progression-free survival and overall survival while maintaining a similar safety profile. So it was a lot of exciting data for patients in the early and metastatic setting for hormone-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer.
What factors do you consider when selecting second-line treatment, and which, if any, do you prioritize?
There are a lot of factors I consider when selecting second-line treatment options for these patients, including efficacy, toxicity profile, and most importantly, the ongoing risk of CNS metastasis. In general, in the absence of a particular toxicity, I tend to use T-DXd for patients in the second-line setting based on the impressive efficacy seen with the DB03 data. But of course, I always keep in mind the risk of ILD, which is about 10 to 15% with T-DXd. So if there's a particular patient I'm concerned about ILD, and I might choose a different agent in the second line setting. The other important factor is CNS metastasis. The DB03 trial included patients with treated CNS metastasis, but did not include any patients with active metastasis, whereas the HER2CLIMB study included patients with active brain metastasis and untreated brain metastasis. So it's important to know that these agents work in patients with active brain metastasis, although there is some data with the Tuxedo study suggesting that T-DXd is also active in patients with active brain metastasis, although the numbers were a lot smaller. Many clinicians would tend to reach for the tucatinib combination based on the HER2CLIMB study in patients with active brain mets, but I feel like both agents have pretty good data in that regard.
How do you view the safety profile of T-DXd versus T-DM1?
Overall, DB03 showed that they had similar rates of treatment-related adverse events. Discontinuation rates were slightly higher with T-DXd compared to T-DM1, and most importantly, the serious toxicity of ILD was definitely higher with T-DXd, about 15% versus 3% in patients with T-DM1. In real life, I think nausea and vomiting and alopecia are bothersome side effects of T-DXd that affect patients. So I tend to communicate that with patients before making a choice for a treatment.
How have you begun to utilize T-DXd in the second line?
I most certainly use T-DXd in the second line setting based on the DB03 data, which made it clear that T-DXd is a winner in the second line setting compared to T-DM1. With a PFS that's four times that seen with T-DM1. So I would most certainly use T-DXd in the second line setting, taking into consideration the toxicity profile of both in patients with any risk of ILD, I tend to make that choice with caution.
And then based on your previous answer, is there still a role for T-DM1? And if so, what do you envision as this role?
Yes, I believe there is a role for T-DM1, probably in the third line setting or beyond. T-DM1 is an overall very well tolerated drug with efficacy seen. So it's an effective ADC and very well tolerated. So it's definitely an option for patients with metastatic disease. And not to forget that T-DM1 is currently our adjuvant treatment of choice for patients who had neoadjuvant therapy and residual disease after surgery in the early stage setting.
And then with the advances for HER2-positive breast cancer, where do you see the role of T-DXd going? And then what would inhibit a physician from using the most efficacious treatment rather than saving it for aggressive disease?
T-DXd is definitely climbing up the ladder in regards to treatment lines. The DB09 study is looking at T-DXd in the first line setting, comparing it to the Cleopatra regimen that's currently the approved first line setting for HER2-positive breast cancer. So you're looking at a three-arm study there with T-DXd plus pertuzumab, T-DXd alone, compared to Cleopatra as a third arm. There's also studies looking at T-DXd in the early setting. So there's DB05 looking at T-DXd versus T-DM1 in patients with residual disease after neoadjuvant therapy and surgery. There's the DB11 trial looking at T-DXd in the neoadjuvant setting. So it's definitely making its way up there. Again, one of the concerns with T-DXd is that serious 10 to 15% risk of pneumonitis. So in the first line setting, when patients are expected to live for 5 or 6 years, it's definitely a concern to be thinking about a serious adverse event such as pneumonitis. And that becomes even more of a concern in the curative setting population. So I think that's something we should be thinking about down the line.
What factors do you consider when thinking about third line treatment?
At this point in their treatment, I mean, they've had accumulative toxicities from their ongoing therapies. So it's an important factor to weigh in toxicity when making decisions on what comes next. Also, another factor is the ongoing risk of CNS metastasis. So it's important if patients have CNS metastasis to choose a treatment that crosses that blood-brain barrier and can control CNS disease as well. And in regards to the toxicity profile, I mean, that's going to differ from one patient to the other, depending on their history and what prior agents they've used. At that point, I think it's a patient-centered decision where we get to make that decision together.
What are some of the biggest unmet needs in HR-positive metastatic breast cancer at the moment?
Yeah, we've made a big leap in hormone-positive breast cancer, especially in regards to the targeted therapies in the frontline setting. Patients are living for a very long time with metastatic disease. However, one big unmet need is those women who progress really rapidly on these drugs. So there's a subset of patients who get started on targeted therapy and endocrine therapy and rapidly progress through it, and they tend to have very poor prognosis overall. So there's a big unmet need there. It's important to understand what's driving this progression, what's the mechanism of resistance with endocrine therapy. That remains a very big question that we would like to understand more about.
Can you describe your thoughts on the data from the CAPItello 291 trial?
Yeah, so I have not utilized capecitabsorptib in clinical practice yet. And I think a lot of us have not been utilizing it yet. But diarrhea and rash seem to be the most common side effects based on the CAPItello trial. There's no way to tell who's more at risk of these adverse events. So it's important to educate patients on what to expect, I think. This AKT inhibitor had a very tolerable safety profile, and it compared favorably to other agents targeting that particular pathway. For example, the risk of hyperglycemia was way lower than what we see with alpelisib, which is an approved PIK3CA inhibitor in that space. Also, the risk of stomatitis was way lower compared to everolimus, as seen in the Valera study.
How are you approaching treatment sequencing with CDK4/6 inhibitors across all lines of therapy?
So I utilize my CDK4/6 inhibitors in the first line setting with endocrine therapy for patients with metastatic hormone positive, HER2 negative breast cancer. Once the patient progresses on that CDK4/6 inhibitor, should we be continuing the CDK4/6 inhibitor beyond progression in the second line setting? I mean, we've seen data from the PACE and the Palmera trial saying that there's no benefit on continuing palbociclib when patient has progressed on palbociclib. This was a little bit different than what we saw with the MAINTAIN trial, where when you switch that endocrine therapy backbone and the CDK4/6 inhibitor in that setting was switched to ribociclib, we saw a little bit of value there. I still think we need more data, and we'll get more data with the post-monarchE trial, which is a phase 3 trial that's designed to answer this particular question.
Given recent data, what is your perception of AKT inhibitors versus PI3K inhibition?
Post-CDK4/6 inhibition, I think there's historically a 2 to 3 month progression-free survival that we're seeing with just standard endocrine therapy, which is a little bit disappointing. So it seems like targeting this pathway after CDK4/6 inhibitor progression seems to be giving us about a 7 month progression-free survival, which is great. It's interesting that in the Capitello trial, the AKT inhibitor capivasertib improved progression-free survival compared to fulvestrin alone in the overall population, regardless of alterations in the AKT pathway, whereas alpelisib, the alpha-specific PI3 kinase inhibitor that's approved in this setting, only works in patients with PIK3CA mutations. So this is definitely something important to note. Also, the side effects were markedly different. So you see less hyperglycemia, as I've mentioned earlier with the capivasertib, more hyperglycemia with the PI3 kinase inhibitor. So it seems like there's some differences there, and more data will sort of be explaining that down the line.
Given the recent data surrounding oral SERDs, how has this information affected your perception of this class of drugs?
So elacestrant was the first oral SERD approved for patients with metastatic hormone-positive HER2-negative breast cancer, particularly with an ESR1 mutation, who have received prior endocrine therapy, and that's based on the EMERALD study. The study really paved the way for oral SERDs as monotherapy for patients with metastatic disease. There's a lot of ongoing studies with other oral SERDs that we're excited to hear about. They're being studied as monotherapy or with combination with other targeted treatments, such as the CDK4/6 inhibitors. We're also seeing them move to the early stage setting. So there are studies evaluating oral SERDs in the adjuvant setting. More to come in regards to oral SERDs and advancements in this area. So pretty exciting.
How do patient preference and quality of life issues affect your treatment selection?
Patient preferences and their quality of life is very, very, very important when I make treatment selections. We as physicians are experts on the breast cancer part. They are experts on their life, on their goals, on what their preferences are. So I'd like to think of it as both of us are bringing our expertise together and coming up with a plan together that fits their needs and their goals for themselves. I definitely prioritize their preferences and quality of life factors with every decision I make when it comes to their treatment.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of Onc Live On Air, sponsored by AstraZeneca. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com. and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. For Twitter, follow us at OncLive. On Facebook, like us at OncLive, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms, so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Onc Live On Air.